everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2025, and you are listening to episode 433, which is a conversation about the film, Am I a Racist? On this episode, I'm joined by Matthew Kennedy, who has an MDiv and is the rector of the Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York. He also serves as the canon for preaching in the Anglican Diocese of the Living Word. Matt has written an online exclusive film review article, and his article is called Am I a Racist? Reveals DEI's Counterfeit Redemption. And you can read this review for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Matt, it's good to have you on the podcast again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, as I just noted, Matt has done a review for us of a documentary called Am I Racist? But before I ask him specifically about the content of that film, I think in the media these days, we're getting a lot of these terms that are in the film, you know, kind of reported on, and some people are not even sure what that is. So there's a lot of terms that are surrounding kind of the modern movement regarding racism in our country. And so I'd like Matt to kind of comment on that and then also talk to us about what the Bible has to say about it before we actually go into the specifics of the film. So first of all, some of the things that are mentioned in the film and that we're hearing in the news lately are terms like critical race theory and anti-racism. What is that? Isn't anti-racism a good thing? Shouldn't we be anti-racist?
Yes, we should be against racism if that's what the term means. But sadly, that's not what the term means. You could probably trace it all back to a nexus of ideas called broadly critical theory, and these ideas were formed by some thinkers out of what was called the Frankfurt School in the early 1930s, who were trying to answer the question, you know, after the Great Depression, Marxists expected the Great Revolution because capitalism had obviously failed. But instead, what they found is that a lot of the working class people who they expected to become Marxists at that point were actually becoming fascists. So these guys, what they did was they decided to expand Marxist analysis of hierarchy away from just an exclusive focus on economics and class and think more about hierarchy in general, the theories of power. And so they just applied Marxist categories to hierarchy. And looking to identify what gives power to oppressors, how do the oppressed, what are the characteristics of the oppressed, what are some of the strategies and stratagems that colonizers use, for example, to oppress people, and then strategizing about how do we liberate the oppressed from the oppressor. So it was at the very beginning, it already had this kind of binary view of the world in which people are separated into oppress versus oppressor, either on the basis of sex or some cultural aspect, or in the case of critical race theory, which kind of comes out of the critical theory milieu in the 1970s, 1980s, that this analysis says, well, the main problem is one of those with white skin have engineered and ordered a system, a society designed to oppress those with black skin. The whole idea of whiteness and blackness is, they argued, was a theoretical construct in order to enable the oppression of the people of color. And so it's kind of a legal and historical theory, and it focused on the systemic power that the white person has in the West in particular. And how to dismantle that legally, how to dismantle that in the educational systems. Anti-racism has takes the insights of critical race theory and applies it. So it's kind of, if you want to think of it maybe as critical race theory, is a theoretical underpinning. anti-racism is also an ideology, but it's an ideology bent on action. Like how we now have to undo all this, all the white privilege that we have, all the oppressive hierarchies that have been built up over the course of many years. And the way we do that is we educate people, make them aware of racism, not just on an individual level, but on a systemic level, and then teach the oppressor, the white person, how to divest himself or herself of their whiteness, of their power, of their privilege, in order to lift up the oppressed, the people with black skin, and dismantle the systemic racist system.
So is this idea of anti-racism, is it a little bit, like you said, it's applying some of these older constructs that started, you know, in the 20th century, but is that kind of more of a modern movement in the 21st century?
Anti-racism, yeah, as it is now, yes, it's a more modern application of these older theories. I guess Ibram Kendi is the one who came out with the book. I think I forget the title, but I think it was Anti-Racism. Something. But his point was, if you are not embracing the actions that you must to dismantle racism in the systems of our world, then you're either an anti-racist or a racist. You're either with the racists, you're supporting the system, you're contributing to the continued oppression of people of color. Or you've joined the revolution. You've seen the light, and you're beginning to help lift up people who have been systemically oppressed for centuries. So that anti-racism is a newer term, and it's a newer ideology. But it's the one that undergirds, you know, pushing critical race theory ideas in schools, elementary schools. It undergirds the impetus to put DEI programs, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs into workplaces and government places, so that that ideology can be passed on and the system's dismantled and so forth.
Before I ask you specifically of DEI, you just mentioned it, and I think that's a little acronym that we're seeing more in the media these days. And that is the question about white privilege, because actually his book, Kendi's book, is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. So I guess it's teaching people how to, you know, oppose racism in just their everyday life as well as societally. And so I just wanted to ask you a little bit about that. So what is this idea of white privilege, which I'm sure he covers in that, and then just this whole idea of this book, how to be an anti-racist, and it's how do you, you know, change yourself? What does it mean? What should a person, if they have white privilege, what is it first of all? And what should they do to not be a racist? How to be an anti-racist?
So when I was growing up in the 90s, you know, racism was always seen as something that is an individual act of bigotry. So you look at someone with a skin color that's not your own, and you act differently toward them on the basis of the skin color. You treat them badly because they're black or because they're white or whatever it is. And so the desire was to be a colorblind society. That was the old way of thinking about racism. Anti-racism says no. See, it's not just an individual. It's not a question of whether you are personally having negative feelings towards somebody because of their skin color. The reality is that skin color determines your place in society. You as a white person, a white male in particular, they would say, you have inherited a place in the social order. You have inherited economic benefits. You've inherited cultural benefits. It's easier for you to get a job. It's easier for you to drive down the street without getting pulled over. It's easier for you to buy a house. All these things, because on the basis of the color of your skin. And so it's not enough for you just not to be not to be individually thinking bad thoughts about somebody because of their black skin. You need to be undoing this unfair advantage that you have been given. And the reason you have, the reason this privilege is such a bad thing, and the reason it implicates you as a white person is because it's built on, well, you know, you go take back to the slave trade, slavery, Jim Crow laws, all of those have created and constructed a society that is just pervaded with race conscious inequalities and inequities. So you participating in that system kind of blithely, living out your life unaware of your great privilege in being white is actually a kind of racist thing, that according to the anti-racists. So you need to do away with you have to divest yourself of the privilege that you've inherited by virtue of your skin color. First thing you need to do is start learning. You know, you do the work, read the books, open your eyes, become, I guess, Marxists of past ages. This would be considered your moment of coming to a revolutionary consciousness, where you see the binaries, you see the oppression where it is, you recognize yourself as an oppressor. And then you have to become an ally. You have to take up action and stand by the people of color and help to redistribute privilege away from people with white skin, dismantle systems that protect that privilege. Privilege in anti-racism, anti-racist thought is a little bit like the means of production in traditional communist thought. It's the thing that you have to, it's the thing that is being held back from the people who are being oppressed.
So just to get an idea of just how impactful, I guess, this book has been, I just want everyone to know that it has almost 5 stars on Amazon with almost 29,000 reviews. So it definitely has made an impact, this whole idea of how to be an anti-racist. And so given all of that, you mentioned it a few minutes ago, something called DEI. So how does this idea of the kind of the oppressor and the oppressed, the idea of being somebody that maybe has inherited the fact that they have inherited just privilege because of the past, things that have happened in the past, and how they need to divest themselves of that and become anti-racist. And so how does that apply to what DEI is? And then functionally, what are some of the things that DEI does?
So DEI is diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's a DEI program is designed to open the eyes, to bring awareness to people in various contexts, whether government, school, whatever, to see the systemic inequality, and then to turn the system around so that it's no longer contributing to and supportive of the old systemic racist system. So if a company, for example, adopts a DEI mindset, their employees will probably put through some kind of training, DEI training program with a DEI instructor who comes in to teach them all this stuff. The company itself will begin to restructure, wanting to be sure to hire in and promote in ways that promote diversity, that is looking for people who check various minority boxes and advancing them or hiring them over and against those who are privileged, punishing in many ways those who will not accept the notion of privilege or bend to it. So it's hard for employees to resist the imposition of a DEI retraining program upon them. And then once they've been through the program, they need to act in accordance with it if they want to be promotable, if they want to be in any way successful in their chosen field. So it's an application of DEI is basically an application of anti-racism into specific contexts, schools, governments, and whatnot. It's broader than just race, though. DEI includes sexuality, quote unquote sexual minorities, and sex. Feminist
gender identity,
right? Yeah, gender, all of that, right? So it's not just race, but race is a big part of it.
I'm so excited! We got a new comment. Thank you so much for rating and reviewing the Postmodern Realities podcast on Apple Podcasts. And I Read Past My Bedtime gave us a review, and I'm so glad. And this person said, Postmodern Realities does an excellent job of balancing contemporary relevance and timeless theological grounding. The host and guests explore a very wide range of topics and always clearly return to the center, God and His glory. They will equip you, yes, you, to talk with friends and family about current events or current media in a Christ-centered way. Thank you so much to I Read Past My Bedtime, and would your voice be heard also along with this reviewer to help us get our podcast to more earbuds, and we would be so grateful for that. So just asking again to consider doing that for us. I hope you're enjoying this conversation with Matt Kennedy. If you'd like to give us a tip, please go to equip.org, go to journal, go to Postmodern Realities, and as I say, every episode at any of our landing pages, you can find a link to give us a tip to continue to bring you this podcast every week free of charge. And with that, back to my conversation with Matt Kennedy. Well, you kind of given us an overview of where we are on some of these policies that have been coming to the front with DEI, as well as some of just the philosophical views that are emerging societally with this anti-racist thought. But I really want to ask you about what the Bible teaches, because does this square with the biblical principles of justice? If we look in the scriptures, it's very clear that God tells us that we should care about the foreigner, that we should love other people as we love ourselves, like we love the Lord, and then love others like we love ourselves. We're to care for the poor. We're to care for widows. And on its face value, it seems like it would be doing that. It would be looking out for people who are marginalized, who don't have voices in society. So help us understand what the Bible teaches about these kinds of issues, and specifically justice, because this seems to be that it would be kind of a justice issue, looking out for those who are oppressed and marginalized.
It's interesting that one of the key frictions, it comes with this notion of the colorblindness is a bad thing, because in the scriptures, the principle that underlies biblical justice is impartiality. That is, not letting some external quality about a person, the person's ethnicity, the person's wealth or lack thereof, the person's background, not letting those aspects of a person determine how you treat the person. So a great example of this is Leviticus 19:15, where we read, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great, but in righteousness shall you judge your neighbor. Now, I think we could probably agree that in most societies, not just in America, but in most societies, the wealthy person has more privilege, has more access to the heights of power and more access to gaining more wealth. But nevertheless, in the scriptures, that privilege is not seen in and of itself as something that the wealthy person, in this case, needs to repent of and be done with. No, when it comes to the application of justice, God's concern for the poor and the person who doesn't have a lot of money doesn't tilt the scales of justice in his or her favor. Nor does a person's wealth tilt the scales of justice in his or her favor. It doesn't matter. The poor person, the rich person, have to be judged in accordance with God's law, not with regard to what they have or don't have. And that's a huge contradiction with all critical theory, but in particular critical race theory and the application, the various applications through anti-racism. It's all predicated on the fact, oh no, if you have this color of skin and you live in this society, well then the scales of justice need to tilt away from you and toward those who are without. And you just don't see that in scripture. You see, like you say, God being the defender of the poor when they're being oppressed. That's true. You see God commanding his people not to oppress them. But the means by which that's carried out is by the equal application of the law, without prejudice toward one or the other. And that's not just a legal category in the Bible. You see it in social and you know, church interactions. So there's that famous passage in James chapter 2 where a man comes in wearing fine clothing and has rings on his finger, and everybody says, oh, come sit up front and, you know, makes way for him. But then the poor man comes in and people ignore him or treat him badly. And James says, you shouldn't do that. You're being partial toward the rich in this case. And then his James's point isn't you need to treat the rich person badly and the poor person well. It's that you need to treat both persons equally as persons, regardless of their wealth or their poverty. So it's a principle that goes beyond beyond the legal sphere. And the reason it goes beyond the legal sphere is because it's a principle that this is true of all God's law. All of God's law that we have in the scriptures are flow out of his character, flow out of his nature. It's not, these aren't arbitrary laws. Like sometimes when you're a kid, your mom might put up some rules on the refrigerator door and they're just kind of, they're not related to her character. They're just things she doesn't want you to do anymore. But all God's laws are reflective of who he is, in his nature and character. And so, in Acts chapter 10, verse 34, Peter has been given a dream by God, while he's sleeping on the roof in Joppa, where God lowers down these unclean animals on a giant picnic blanket or something, and God says, kill and eat. And Peter says, well, I've never eaten anything unclean in my life. And God says, do it. And then he says, what I've made clean, don't call unclean. And that happens three times. And then right after the third time, there are some Gentiles at the front door of the house he's staying, seeking him. And he goes. He goes with them, and they take him to a Gentile centurion, a Roman centurion named Cornelius, who has been visited by an angel who told him to send for Peter. And Cornelius wants to hear the gospel. And then Peter says, truly, I understand that God shows no partiality. The reason impartiality is at the core of biblical justice is because God is not a respecter of persons. He judges equally. He doesn't let your race or your skin color or your whatever blind him, or to in your favor or against you. So it all flows out of God's nature and character. Another aspect of this, another biblical principle that I think gets confused in the modern era is that the notion of race isn't a biblical notion. At least the notion of race based on skin color is not a biblical notion. I actually agree with some critical race theorists who say the race is a construct. It's not a social construct. It's not inherent to who we are. But I disagree about why it's been constructed, but they're right about that. And in the Bible, the differentiation is an ethnic one. So for example, there are Romans and there are Greeks and there are Scythians named in the New Testament. They all have white skin, but they're not called white people. They're called Romans, Greeks, and Scythians. And the same thing with people who have black skin color, the Ethiopian or the Cushite or the Nubian. They're not called black people. The black skin is recognized, but that's not how they're categorized. They're categorized as Ethiopians or Cushites or Nubians. And this is important because you know, when it comes to taking responsibility for past oppression, which is what, according to anti-racism, I'm supposed to do as a white person, I'm supposed to take responsibility for the sins or for the injustice of white people, that there is biblical precedent for taking responsibility and redressing the sins of one's predecessors, so long as you are identified with them. So for, you know, one of the greatest prayers in all of the Old Testament comes from Daniel chapter 9, where Daniel confesses and seeks mercy for the idolatries committed by the people of Israel, his people, for generations. Even though Daniel isn't an idolater, he hasn't committed those sins, but he confesses those sins. But, and this is crucial, he doesn't take responsibility and confess the sins of all brown-skinned Semitic people. He's talking about his particular people. Maybe a modern application of this principle is, it might be appropriate for the grandson of a Ku Klux Klan member to acknowledge his family's past role in racism and make amends for that, even though he's not personally guilty of it, to express regret for that. It might be appropriate for a pastor, as I use this example in the article, for a pastor of a church that once taught racism in the past to acknowledge and renounce that that error. But I, you know, if just because my skin color is white doesn't mean that I need to apologize for what people have, I have no relationship with at all. But the only thing I share with them is the skin color, the color of my skin, for what they did maybe in the 1800s. I can't repent. That has no bearing on who I am or any relationship to me. My relatives came in from Canada after the Civil War. So I'm not going to apologize for what a person with white skin did in the South. So there's, I guess the question of where responsibility lies for oppression is another place where the Bible and anti-racism would clash. And finally, and this, I think, is the most important thing, is that, you know, in many ways, once you adopt the anti-racist mindset, and let's say you're in the oppressor class, you have white skin, there's really no way out. Your whole life then becomes one of trying to get out from under the shame. You're guilty by virtue of who you are. And no matter how much work you do, no matter how many books you read, no matter how many classes you take, you're still going to be in that oppressor class. You're still going to be needing to apologize for who you are. You're still going to have shame. Whereas in the Bible, you know, even there's always a way out of sin, no matter what you've done, and no matter even the sin that we have as by virtue of being born with original sin. You can always, when you repent, you are cleansed, forgiven, and justified, but through faith in Jesus Christ. It's over at that point. God throws your sins behind his back. He's blind to them. He credits you with righteousness. He imputes your sin to Jesus. You are set free and liberated from the sin. And that applies to both oppressors and the oppressed. It's applied impartially to all who believe. And there's just nothing like that in anti-racism. It does have a lot of religious aspects, and it talks about redemption and liberation, but it actually brings slavery and hardship to those who embrace it.
Well, now I want to set the, you know, stage a little bit for the actual, you know, asking about this film, that a documentary that was released in the fall of 2024. And the title of your film review says, it kind of refers to anti-racism and labels it as a counterfeit redemption. And you were just kind of talking about that a little bit. What do you mean by a counterfeit redemption?
Well, you know, in the film, it is couched as Matt Walsh's redemption story. He's on a journey to be redeemed of his whiteness. It's all tongue in cheek, of course, but he sees something on the television in a diner. And he wonders, am I a racist? Right, and then that sets him off on his journey, and he's trying to follow all the rules of anti-racism and learn them, follow them, embrace them. He becomes a DEI instructor, and the film in all of this is an attempt to escape the evil. Escape the taint of being an oppressor, and we can talk more closely about how the film actually unfolds later if you'd like. But in the end, it really, this process culminates with a kind of a struggle session where he is leading a group of people through a class and on DEI, and you know, he wheels in someone who, I guess it's an actor, but someone playing as though he is his racist uncle Frank, who told a racist joke 20 years prior, and he invites the people in the class to mock or to denigrate Uncle Frank. He starts off. He said, he told them, you've dehumanized people, you've marginalized people. And then two women in the class, they curse him. They curse this old man sitting in a wheelchair in front of them. And then one woman there says, I cut off my whole family because of their racism. These are two white women. And then this is the culmination of the film, I think. Walsh pulls out a box of whips and paddles for the self-flagellation instruction. Like, here's how you, because you can't get out from under the weight of the guilt of being white, you're just going to have to beat yourself. And there are, it seems like, from my viewing of the film, people are ready to do it. This is what I mean by the anti-racism brings down the law, or if not the biblical law, but a moral law, constructed moral law, down on your conscience, and then it doesn't give you any way to get out of it, because it's a false system. There is no way to get out of it, and so you're just left with the shame, and it's so great, people feel so badly that they're willing to beat themselves to prove or to show that they're not really part of the racist system, but they can't get out from under it. So I think the film is successful because it does uncover this counterfeit redemption that's being offered to people through the system.
So I want to talk about the movie now, and what is this documentary about? You kind of said it's couched as his journey, Matt Walsh's journey. Who is Matt Walsh?
Matt Walsh, he is a podcaster, but he does video podcasts. Vlogger? I don't know. But he's a very popular public figure in conservative circles. He's Roman Catholic, I believe. He identifies as a Christian, but he's very conservative politically. And so he has a pretty wide following. He did another documentary called What is a Woman, in which he went to different experts and asked that question, quote unquote experts, and asked that question because, you know, the people who are involved in the trans movement, can they define what a woman is? And it turned out in this documentary that not many of them were able to define what a woman is. So this is kind of the same idea. It's kind of a, I wouldn't say mockumentary, but it's an expose. The idea is to take anti-racism and DEI to its logical conclusion. And he does that, I said a minute ago, and I'll just kind of walk through it. He does that by starting first doing the work. He goes to a library, he checks out a whole bunch of anti-racist books, reads them. He decides he's going to go to a workshop, and he, of course, wears a disguise, and not a very good one, but he wears a disguise, and he just plays the earnest, I want to learn, I want to be here. He overdoes it, but I describe how he overdoes it in the article on purpose. He takes everything to its literal extreme in this anti-racist workshop, and ultimately they realize who he is and they kick him out. But he just goes to different venues, always in a kind of disguise, but not a good disguise. If anyone really wanted to know who he was, they could find out. He goes to, for example, this, what is it called? There's these dinners, Race to Dinner. and this is, there's two women who for $5,000 will a piece will teach white women how racist they are over dinner. And Matt Walsh gets access to this by pretending to be one of the waiters who are serving the food in this. And he can't help but join the conversation, because by this time he's become a licensed DEI instructor. He plays along with the whole thing, taking all of the assumptions that they have and agreeing with them and taking them to the logical conclusion, which actually turns out to be rather absurd. So it's very, all the way through, it's very funny. It some places is very cringe. Like that particular scene, to me, I had to walk out of the room because it was really embarrassing. But my kids thought it was really funny. And most of the scenes have most of the interviews and the workshops and the classes that he does have that kind of humorous element where he's deadpanning. We know he's not serious, but the people who are teaching him don't know that. And so he's deadpanning, he's responding to them in overly literal ways. They get frustrated and they end up just exposing themselves in many ways. The one of the famous scenes is he actually manages to get an interview with Robin DiAngelo, who's the author of White Fragility, which is another really famous anti-racism book. And he paid her $15,000 for this interview. And the interview culminates with Walsh has brought in his producer, who's black. His producer's name's Ben, and he's part of the interview. And as he's talking with D'Angelo, he looks at Ben and he says, "You know what? I feel like I'm all my privilege and all of my oppression. I need to start paying you reparations right now." So he pulls out his wallet and he gives $20 to his producer, Ben, as reparations. And then he asks D'Angelo, "Well, are you going to do the same thing? Are you going to give him money for reparations because you're white?" And she says, "Well, you know, that's, reparations is a systemic thing, not an individual thing." And Matt Walsh says, "I'm not waiting for the system." And so she finally gives him money. She finally gives Ben money. And she knew there was something fishy about the interview. She didn't know what it was during the interview. Later, she realized, and she wrote an article about how she thinks Walsh deceived her or lied to her in order to secure the interview. And Walsh denies that, but that's the kind of thing he's going for in all of these scenes.
So obviously it might have a specific kind of audience because it was done by, you know, a conservative group website where Matt Walsh has his podcast, but do you think the film is successful in terms of just kind of showing like literalism in terms of what they believe in trying to?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it's very successful. It does reveal the cruelty of the system for those caught up in it. It reveals clearly also, I think, a lot of the grift in the system, how much money is passing hands. The workshop person, the workshop I told you about where he was finally kicked out after he was identified, the person who facilitated that is Brashia Wade, she's a grief expert or anti-racist instructor. And she got paid $30,000 for that workshop. And there were like 14 people there. I mean, that's a lot. So there's a lot of money being passed, being made by those who are pushing, this system on people. People are shilling out lots of money so that they can feel a sense of being right, being in the right, even though they come out feeling even more guilty, even more ashamed of the color of their skin and their participation in their privilege or whatever it might be. So it's a real cruel, sad system that I think Am I Racist does a fantastic job of exposing. People are caught up in this. Most recently, there's been a backlash against DEI, but still, there are lots of people who are caught up in this in their workplace, in their school, and it's a terrible, torturous system, spiritually speaking.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Robin DiAngelo, who is white, and she's actually the author of this bestseller called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, that she felt deceived. You know, she was paid for this interview, but she also felt deceived by Matt Walsh. And so some people who have reviewed the film have said he has used questionable ethics to try to dupe some of these people who have deep conviction about these issues, and they are trying to make a difference to help people understand their, you know, why racism is bad, especially if you're a white person, you know, what all that means, why white people can't talk about racism, as she has in her subtitle. So why do they think that this film, just the filming of it itself, is unethical?
Well, one of the strongest critics, who is also a very conservative person, a conservative Christian, Dr. Denny Burke, he's a professor at Boyce College, and he's also the president of CBMW, the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. So he's no liberal by any stretch of the imagination. He doesn't think there's any case ever where a Christian can legitimately use deception to lie in order to bring about what Matt Walsh has done. I'll quote him. Burke says, exposing and lampooning DEI lunacy is a good cause. I want to see the demise of this woke ideology as much as Walsh does, but still, is it okay to use lies in service of the truth? So Burke just thinks there's a better way. Now, there are other criticisms come from other Christians, Andrew Walker, who is the managing editor of World Opinion. He also is critical of the ethics, but he took a different tack. He says that not all deception is lying, just like not all killing is murder. You know, you can kill in a war and it's not considered murder. And Andrew Walker would say you can deceive in a war or in a very serious situation without actually being guilty of the sin of lying. And he brings in the Hebrew midwives, for example, who deceived Pharaoh to rescue the Hebrew baby boys, or Rahab, the prostitute, who lied to save the spies in Jericho. Those are two women. Those are two cases where the people who use deception are never rebuked in the scriptures. They're upheld actually as heroines, and God blessed them for their deception. So Andrew Walker, though, says he's not quite sure that anti-racism rises to the level where it would justify the type of deception that was used by Walsh, he says, because, you know, Walsh, he didn't tell people what the purpose of the interview was. He was wearing a disguise, although Walsh says anybody could have seen through it. He came in under false pretenses. And whereas that might be justifiable in some cases, like a Gestapo agent knocking on your door, searching for hidden Jews, I think Andrew Walker would say it's definitely a case where deception would be justified. But is it justified in this case? And he seems to come down, this is in a podcast, The Bully Pulpit, he seems to come down on the side of saying it's not justified. I love Diddy Burke. He's a great writer and scholar, and I really appreciate all of his work. I think I disagree with him about the ethics of just there never being a case where you can use deception. I don't agree with that, and maybe I'm not articulating his position as he would, and if so, I apologize. But I tend to side more with Andrew Walker on this, but I disagree with him that anti-racism doesn't rise to the level of a clear and present threat, a spiritual threat to millions of people. It does. It crushes souls, I think. So I would, I tend to say that if you take the view that sometimes deception does not fall into the category of sinful lying, I would argue that the deception in this particular case would not fall into that category of lying. He did kind of the same thing in this movie or this film, Matt Walsh did, that was done by the Center for Medical Progress, where they had those hidden camera interviews with Planned Parenthood officials who were talking about marketing organs of babies, right? They had to use deception to get those interviews. But that those interviews blew open a murderous and terrible system of death and greed that was going on underneath the surface. And I think anti-racism does pretty much the same thing with, I'm sorry, Am I Racist? Does pretty much the same thing with anti-racism.
So what about the movie itself? Do you think, you know, there's different views? You just talked about two different views and you had a different one as well. So three different views about even, you know, would it make some Christians uncomfortable seeing it, knowing that Matt wasn't on the up and up for how he procured these particular interviews, plus he paid some of the people. But do you think it's a movie that Christians should watch or could watch?
I do. We watched it with our children. I didn't see anything that would prevent them from doing that. I think it'd be wise and good to have a conversation about the ethics of deception and say, you know, whether you could watch the film and come away and tell people who watched it with you, well, I really disagree with you with lying for any reason. You could take Denny Burke's view. But the film is of such value in exposing this ideology that I think it's an important thing for people to see. It's an important thing to watch.
I thought it was interesting in the trailer. They even show Robin DiAngelo when before they start rolling, she just says, "Oh, you know, you just couldn't talk to anybody about this." Like she kind of said the end thing, like, maybe some people, this wouldn't be good, you know, if they knew what we were going to talk about.
Right.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah, it was very interesting in the trailer. You could just see that in the trailer. Well, this is a lot of good food for thought. And I think this would be a very interesting movie night for Christians just to talk through just the issues that you talked about. What is biblical justice and how does that differ than some of these other forms that we're finding that actually have their roots in Marxist theory? And, you know, recently I heard an author talk about feminism on Hank's podcast. Maybe it was a year or so ago. And she had done a lot of research on feminism. And some of the views that they used to get in Marxist theory back in the 60s, it's just so accepted today that it really made me think. I realized, like, I wouldn't call myself a feminist. I wouldn't agree with any of their views. But yet, some of these views come in such unsuspecting ways that you don't realize, oh, okay, maybe I have seen that come in. In other words, she was positing that Betty Friedan, really, she couldn't just come out and say, here's this Marxist theory. What she had to do was put down the American housewife as being like a Nazi concentration camp victim. But besides that, the reason is because women have to have value, and how you have value is to be a worker outside the home. And so now it's kind of like, it's almost, you know, women, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, you know, it's like you struggle with, is there any value to be at home as opposed to doing work outside the home? But that's really a Marxist view.
Yeah. I mean, a great book that helps trace all this back is Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman. He goes all the way back to the source and said, you know, one of the main things that Marxists wanted to do, realized they had to do in the early 20th century was to break up the nuclear family traditional family, because the family was the vehicle through which traditional morality and values were passed on. And so you had to break that up. And one way to break that up was to liberate the women. Another way to break that up is to liberate the children through sex. And so a lot of the modern leftist ideologies that we take for granted actually have a source back in mid 20th century, early 20th century Marxist thought.
So this is definitely a lot of food for thought as we think about this documentary. And so now for kind of a fun question for Matt, it's, you know, we're into February, but I know you may or may not do resolutions, but when you get to December and you look back on 2025, what is a word that you hope will have described your year?
thin. I gained about 10 pounds last year, so I'm trying to get that off. So hopefully I'll be back and I'll be snapped back into shape by this coming Christmas.
Well, that's a great goal to have. Well, thanks, Matt, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to episode 433 of the Postmodern Realities Podcast with today's guest, Matt Kennedy, who has written an online exclusive film review of the documentary, Am I a Racist? You can read his film review and article at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.